A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about freight forwarders, which he calls one of those players in the logistics chain that few people have heard of. The shipping lines are these massive monoliths, too large for most businesses to deal with directly, and freight forwarders are the essential oil that greases the whole machine. He wants to know what they actually do, who the biggest ones are, whether they handle customs or just freight aggregation, and whether there's a hierarchy where smaller forwarders get consolidated by larger ones. Honestly, it's one of those industries where the scale of it is invisible until you look.
It really is, and the numbers are staggering once you do look. There are roughly 160,000 freight forwarding companies operating globally right now. The market was valued somewhere around $210 billion in 2024, and it's projected to hit about $285 billion by 2032. That's not niche. That's one of the quiet backbones of global trade.
160,000 companies doing something most people have never heard of. That's like discovering there's a whole parallel civilization of people who just
move boxes, negotiate space, navigate customs, arrange multimodal transport, consolidate cargo from 16 different shippers into one container so nobody pays for empty space they don't need. It's genuinely complex work. A freight forwarder is essentially a travel agent for cargo. But that analogy understates it because a travel agent doesn't usually handle your visa, your customs declaration, your insurance, and your warehousing.
It's a travel agent who also does your immigration paperwork, stores your luggage, and insures your trip. That's less catchy.
Less catchy, but more accurate. The core job is arranging the movement of goods from point A to point B across international borders. But they're doing it by buying space on ships, planes, trucks, and trains. They don't own the assets themselves. They're non-asset-based by design. Maersk owns the ships. Forwarders buy slots on them.
That's an important distinction. They don't own the physical transport. They own the relationships, the expertise, and the consolidation economics. So when a mid-sized furniture company in Ohio needs to get a shipment from a factory in Vietnam to their warehouse, they don't call Maersk directly. They call a forwarder.
Right, and Maersk doesn't want that call either. The shipping lines are built for volume. They want to deal with a few thousand forwarders who each bring them aggregated container loads, not 100,000 individual shippers each with half a container of patio furniture. The forwarder solves a matching problem at scale.
The forwarder is basically a wholesaler of shipping capacity.
They buy space in bulk at rates individual shippers could never get, then sell it in smaller portions at a markup. But the value add goes way beyond rate arbitrage. They're handling documentation, bills of lading, certificates of origin, packing lists, commercial invoices. They're arranging cargo insurance. They're coordinating the handoff between a truck in Hanoi, a ship from Haiphong, and a rail line from Long Beach to Chicago. Any one of those links breaks and the shipment sits.
Presumably, somebody's frozen fish is defrosting while that gets sorted out.
Which is why the forwarder also does what's called exception management. When the ship gets rerouted because of a port strike or a container falls off in heavy weather or customs lags, a shipment for inspection, the forwarder is the one untangling it. The shipper in Ohio isn't on the phone with the port of Rotterdam at 3 in the morning. The forwarder is.
That's the part that probably justifies their existence more than the rate savings. Anyone can find a cheaper rate online now. There are digital platforms for that. But when something goes wrong, the platform doesn't have a relationship with the harbor master.
And things go wrong constantly. The Freightos blog had a piece noting that forwarders are essentially logistics consultants. They're advising on optimal routing, trade compliance, encoder means, which is a whole separate labyrinth we could spend an hour on. The expertise is the product as much as the book in itself.
The hidden grammar of global trade. We've talked about that before. Those three-letter codes that determine who pays for what and where risk transfers. Most businesses don't know their FOB from their DDP, and that's precisely where the forwarder earns their fee.
On the customs question, yes, freight forwarders absolutely handle customs clearance. It's one of their core functions. Many forwarders have in-house customs brokerage divisions or partner tightly with customs brokers. The distinction gets blurry because some companies are both. A forwarder might be a licensed customs broker themselves, or they might have a dedicated brokerage team. Either way, when you hire a full-service forwarder, you're typically getting door-to-door service that includes clearing customs at both ends.
It's not just freight aggregation. They're the single point of contact for the entire journey, including the regulatory handshake at each border.
And that's where a lot of the value lives, because customs clearance is not a trivial problem. Tariff classifications alone, the harmonized system codes, there are over 5,000 six-digit codes. Misclassify your product and you're looking at penalties, delays, or both. Forwarders handle this thousands of times a month. They know that knitted cotton gloves and woven cotton gloves are different codes with different duty rates. That's not something a furniture company shipping clerk is going to know.
Knitted versus woven? Sounds like the customs equivalent of a tax auditor asking whether your home office is really a home office.
Now, on the hierarchy question, this is where it gets interesting. The prompt asked whether even the largest forwarders have direct interface with shipping lines, and whether there's a hierarchy where smaller forwarders get consolidated by larger ones. The short answer is yes, on both counts. The top-tier forwarders absolutely deal directly with the shipping lines. They're signing service contracts and getting allocated space, allocations, directly from carriers like Maersk, MSC, CMA, CGM. But below them, there's a whole ecosystem of mid-tier and small forwarders who often can't get that direct access.
The small forwarder is essentially a subcontractor to the large forwarder.
A small forwarder in, say, Memphis might have great relationships with local shippers. They know every manufacturer within 50 miles, but they don't have enough volume to negotiate directly with a global carrier. So, they'll buy space through a larger forwarder or through what's called a co-loader. A consolidator that aggregates cargo from multiple smaller forwarders to create enough volume to get favorable rates.
It's forwarders all the way down. The shipper hires a small forwarder, who buys from a mid-tier forwarder, who buys from a top-tier forwarder, who buys from the shipping line. Each layer takes a margin and adds a service.
Sometimes it's not even that linear. Some small forwarders are essentially sales agents for larger ones. They operate under the larger forwarder's contracts and branding. Others are independent but depend on co-loaders for access to capacity. The industry term is invoc non-vessel. Operating common carrier, which is a forwarder that issues its own bills of lading and essentially acts as a carrier to the shipper, even though it doesn't own ships.
The shipper thinks they're dealing with a carrier. They're actually dealing with a forwarder who's dealing with a forwarder who's dealing with a carrier. It's like Inception. But with shipping containers.
It works remarkably well most of the time. Now, on the largest forwarders, the top tier is dominated by a handful of names. Caney plus Nagel, based in Switzerland, is consistently the world's largest by revenue and volume. They handled something like 4.4 million TEUs of sea freight in 2024. DHL Global Forwarding is number two. That's the forwarding arm of Deutsche Post DHL. Then you've got DSV, the Danish company that acquired Panalpina in 2019 and then bought Agility's global integrated logistics business in 2021. They've been on an acquisition spree.
4.4 million TEUs. For context, what's a typical container ship carry these days?
The largest ones now are pushing 24,000 TEUs. So Keen plus Nagel is moving the equivalent of about 180 fully loaded ultra-large container vessels per year. That's one forwarder.
That's absurd. So Kenny plus Nagel is effectively a shipping line without ships.
In terms of volume, they're bigger customers to the carriers than many actual shipping lines are. The top five forwarders, Quain plus Nagel, DHL, DSV, DB Schenker, and Sinotrans, control a huge share of global freight volume. DB Schenker is the logistics arm of Deutsche Bahn, the German railway. Sinotrans is Chinese state-owned. And then just below them, you've got names like Expeditors, C. Robinson, Bolloré, Nippon Express, and UPS Supply Chain Solutions.
Expeditors. That's the one based in Seattle, right? Famously no-nonsense culture.
Yes, founded in 1979. They're interesting because they're purely a forwarder and customs broker, no asset-heavy legacy, very focused. Robinson is massive in North American trucking brokerage, but also has a significant global forwarding division. The landscape has been consolidating rapidly. DSV bought Panalpina, then Agility's GIL. Ken plus Nagel acquired Apex International in 2021, which gave them a huge boost in trans-Pacific air freight. DB Schenker itself was up for sale. There were reports that DSV was bidding, but Deutsche Bahn ended up selling it to a private equity consortium led by CVC in 2024 for around 14 billion euros.
14 billion euros for a freight forwarder. That's a real business.
It's an enormous business. And the consolidation trend is driven by the same dynamics you see in many industries. Scale advantages in technology, broader service offerings, and the ability to negotiate better rates from carriers. A forwarder moving 5 million TEUs a year gets a very different phone call from Maersk than one moving 50,000.
The hierarchy isn't just informal, it's structural. The big get bigger, the small either get acquired or get squeezed into niche roles.
Though I should say, the small forwarders aren't disappearing. There are still tens of thousands of them, and they survive through specialization and relationships. A forwarder that specializes in, say, temperature-controlled pharmaceutical shipments to West Africa, or oversized machinery for mining operations in South America. That's not a business. A giant like Quaney plus Nagel is going to outcompete through scale alone. The expertise is deeply specific.
That's the local knowledge moat. Same reason a boutique law firm survives next to a global one. You're not hiring the firm, you're hiring the partner who knows the judge.
And in forwarding, you're hiring the person who knows the port director in Mombasa, or who understands the specific documentation quirks for exporting used vehicles to Nigeria. That kind of knowledge doesn't scale.
Let's talk about the digital disruption angle, because that's been the story for a decade now. The Uber for Freight, platforms that were supposedly going to disintermediate forwarders entirely. Freightos, Flexport, dozens of others. What actually happened?
It's been a mixed bag. Flexport is the most prominent example. They raised over $2 billion, positioned themselves as a tech-forward digital forwarder, got a lot of attention when they brought in former Amazon executives. They had a very public leadership shakeup in 2023 when their CEO was ousted and then reinstated within days. The digital platforms have definitely made pricing more transparent and booking easier, but they haven't replaced the forwarder function. They've mostly become forwarders themselves.
The disruptors became the incumbents in training.
Freightos is a marketplace where forwarders can list rates, but the actual service is still delivered by forwarders. Flexport is a licensed forwarder and customs broker. They just have a better user interface. The lesson seems to be that you could digitize the booking process, but you can't digitize the problem solving when a shipment gets stuck. Somebody still has to make the phone calls.
The software eats the world, but it still has to call the port authority.
Port authorities are not known for their API integrations.
The hierarchy picture is something like, at the top, the shipping lines with the physical assets. Below them, the mega forwarders. Caney plus Nagel, DHL, DSV, who deal directly with the lines and move millions of containers. Below them, the mid-tier and regional forwarders who may or may not have direct carrier relationships. Below them, the small specialists. And below them, the co-loaders and sub-agents who aggregate the smallest players. And at every level, customs brokerage is either bundled in or closely partnered.
That's a good summary. One nuance, some of the mega forwarders do own some assets. Kenne plus Nagel has warehousing and distribution centers. DHL obviously has the express parcel network. But the core ocean and air forwarding business is asset light. They're buying space on vessels and planes they don't own.
What about the margins in this business? If you're a travel agent for cargo, travel agent margins are famously thin. Is forwarding a high volume, low margin game?
Generally, yes, though it varies. Gross margins on ocean freight forwarding might be in the mid-teens percentage. Wise, net margins in the low single digits. Air freight is higher margin but lower volume. The real money often comes from value-added services. Customs brokerage, insurance, warehousing, supply chain consulting. The basic freight booking is almost a loss leader to win the relationship, and then you make money on everything wrapped around it.
It's the printer and ink model. Give away the razor, sell the blades.
Or, in forwarding terms, get the container booking, sell the customs clearance, cargo insurance, warehousing, last mile delivery, and trade compliance consulting.
One thing I'm curious about, during COVID, when shipping rates went insane and container spot rates went from $2,000 to $20,000, what happened to forwarders? Were they printing money or getting crushed?
Both, depending on their contract structure. Forwarders with long-term contracts at fixed rates with carriers, they were sitting pretty because they could sell space at spot market rates that were 5 to 10 times what they'd locked in. Forwarders who relied on the spot market themselves got hammered. There were also a lot of disputes because carriers were rolling cargo, bumping contracted shipments to make room for higher-paying spot cargo. Forwarders spent a huge amount of time fighting to get their allocated space honored.
Rolling cargo! That's the phrase for when your container gets bumped to a later sailing.
It's a euphemism for your stuff isn't getting on that ship, good luck. During the pandemic, roll rates were hitting 30-40% on some routes. Forwarders were the ones absorbing the fury from shippers whose Christmas inventory was sitting on a dock in Shanghai.
That's a job I don't want. Hello, your holiday season is canceled. Please hold.
Yet the industry survived and grew. Global trade volume keeps expanding, supply chains keep getting more complex, and every new trade regulation or tariff regime creates more need for expertise. The forwarder isn't going away.
Let me ask about the relationship with the shipping lines more specifically. You mentioned allocations. The forwarder gets a certain number of container slots guaranteed. How does that negotiation actually work? Is it an annual contract? Does the forwarder commit to volume, or just get an option?
It's typically annual service contracts negotiated once a year, usually with the trans-Pacific contracts aligned around May 1st. The forwarder commits to a minimum quantity commitment, an MQC, of containers over the contract period, and in return gets a fixed rate and guaranteed space allocation. If they don't meet the MQC, they may face penalties. If they exceed it, additional volume goes at whatever the prevailing rate is.
It's like a corporate phone plan. You commit to a certain number of lines, and if you go over, you pay the overage rate.
That's not a bad analogy. And just like phone plans, the big corporate accounts get rates that individual consumers never see. A forwarder with 100,000 TEU annual commitment is paying a fraction of what a small forwarder pays on the spot market.
What about the spot market itself? Is there an actual exchange where container slots are traded? Or is it all bilateral negotiation?
It's mostly bilateral, though there are digital marketplaces now. Freightos, as we mentioned, and others like Zenetta for rate benchmarking. But the spot market is still largely a phone and email affair. A forwarder has a relationship with a carrier's sales representative. They call up and say, I need 5 containers from Shanghai to Los Angeles next week. What's your rate? And they negotiate. It's surprisingly analog.
In 2026, the global shipping spot market runs on phone calls. That's simultaneously absurd and completely unsurprising.
It's one of those industries where personal relationships still matter enormously. A forwarder who's been doing business with the same carrier rep for 15 years gets their calls returned. A new entrant with a slick app might not.
The moat is literally a Rolodex.
A very valuable Rolodex. And that's why the consolidation we talked about is partly about acquiring those relationships. When DSV bought Panalpina, they weren't just buying a book of business. They were buying decades of carrier relationships, customer relationships, and local market knowledge across dozens of countries.
The M&A wave in forwarding is essentially a roll-up of relationships. You can't build a 40-year relationship with a port director in Santos by writing a check, but you can buy the company that has one.
And that's also why the integration of these acquisitions is notoriously difficult. Forwarding is a people business. When you acquire a forwarder, the assets go home every night. If you mishandle the integration and the key people leave, you've just bought an expensive office lease and some forklifts.
The assets go home every night. That's the entire knowledge economy in one sentence.
It really is. And it's why the tech platforms have struggled to fully disintermediate. Software doesn't have relationships. It doesn't get drinks with the carrier rep at industry conferences. It doesn't know that the customs officer in Jeddah is particularly picky about the wording on certificates of origin.
If I'm a business shipping internationally, what's the practical decision tree? Do I go with a mega forwarder, a mid-tier specialist, or a local shop? What's the trade-off?
The mega forwarders give you global coverage, competitive rates, and sophisticated technology platforms, track and trace, analytics, integration with your ERP system. But you're a small fish in a big pond. If you're shipping 50 containers a year, you're not getting the A-team at Quain plus Nagel. A mid-tier forwarder might give you more attention and still have decent global reach. A small specialist gives you deep expertise in your specific lane or commodity, but limited geographic coverage and less negotiating power.
It's the classic boutique versus big firm calculus, applied to boxes on boats.
And many large shippers use a mix. They might have a global contract with a mega forwarder for their main lanes, but use specialists for tricky markets or high-value shipments. There's no one-size-fits-all.
Let's circle back to customs brokerage, because I think that's the part most people would find surprising. The idea that the same company arranging the ship booking is also handling your legal compliance with customs authorities. That's a lot of trust to place in one vendor.
It is, and it's heavily regulated as a result. In the United States, customs brokers have to be licensed by CBP, Customs and Border Protection, which involves passing an exam, background checks, and continuing education. In the EU, each member state has its own licensing regime. Forwarders that offer customs brokerage are holding themselves out as compliance professionals, and the liability is real. If they misclassify your goods and you underpay duties, you're on the hook. Not just for the back duties, but for penalties and interest.
If they're doing it for thousands of shipments a month, one error multiplied across all those shipments is an existential problem.
Which is why the big forwarders invest heavily in compliance departments and customs, specific technology. They're running tariff classification databases, denied party screening against sanctions lists, free trade agreement qualification tools. It's a whole compliance infrastructure sitting behind what looks like a simple freight booking.
Denied party screening. That's checking whether you're accidentally shipping to someone on a sanctions list.
Yes, and it's not optional. You're required to screen every party in the transaction against government-restricted party lists. Ship to a sanctioned entity and you're looking at criminal liability. Forwarders handle that screening so the shipper doesn't have to build that capability themselves.
The forwarder is also your sanctions compliance department. The job keeps expanding.
It really does. And with the geopolitical environment being what it is, new sanctions on Russia, evolving restrictions on China, export controls on advanced technology, the compliance burden has only grown. Forwarders are de facto gatekeepers of trade compliance for much of the global economy.
That's a lot of responsibility for an industry most people have never heard of. 160,000 companies, quietly keeping global trade legal and moving.
They've been doing it for a long time. The modern freight forwarding industry traces back to the 19th century, companies that started as customs brokers and shipping agents in port cities, arranging paperwork and cargo for merchants. The basic function hasn't changed that much. The scale has.
Everything old is new again, just with more containers and better software. Speaking of which, what's the state of visibility these days? Can the average shipper now track their container the way they track an Amazon package?
It's getting better, but it's still not seamless. The big forwarders have invested heavily in visibility platforms. CUNY plus Nagel has MyKN, DSV has MyDSV, Expeditors has XP. These give shippers real-time or near-real-time tracking across ocean, air, and ground. But the data is only as good as the feeds from the carriers, and carrier data quality varies wildly. A container on a Maersk ship gets good tracking. A container on a smaller regional carrier might go dark for days.
The tracking bar goes up, but the floor is still pretty low.
The floor is still, your container is somewhere in the Indian Ocean, we'll let you know when it hits port. The industry is working on it. There are initiatives around IoT sensors, satellite tracking, standardized data exchange, but it's not Amazon level yet and probably won't be for a while. The supply chain is too fragmented.
The Amazon tracking experience has ruined us for everything else. We now expect to watch our package travel in real time on a map, and if a container ship can't provide that, we're disappointed in global trade.
For everyone else, you're stitching together data from a dozen different parties, each with their own systems and incentives.
All right, let's zoom out. If someone listening is in a business that ships internationally and they're evaluating freight forwarders, what's the one thing they should ask that most people don't think to ask?
I'd say, ask about their claims process. Not just their insurance offering, but what actually happens when a shipment is damaged or lost. How do they handle it? What's their claims ratio? How long does resolution typically take? Everyone focuses on rates and transit times, but the true test of a forwarder is how they perform when something goes wrong, and something will go wrong.
That's good advice for almost any service industry. Don't ask how they perform when things are smooth. Ask how they perform when the ship hits the proverbial iceberg.
In forwarding, the iceberg is usually less dramatic but more frequent. A container got rolled, customs flagged a shipment, the trucking company went bankrupt mid-delivery, a port strike shut down operations for a week. The forwarder's ability to recover from those things is what you're really paying for.
The recovery capability is the product. The booking is just the wrapper.
That's a perfect way to put it. And it's why the industry, despite all the digitization and consolidation, remains fundamentally a relationship and expertise business. You can't automate recovery from a port strike.
To wrap up the prompt's specific questions, freight forwarders arrange international cargo movement. They don't own the ships or planes. They absolutely handle customs clearance either directly or through affiliated brokers. And yes, there's a distinct hierarchy. Mega forwarders deal directly with shipping lines, while smaller forwarders often buy space through larger ones or co-loaders. The big five are Kenny Plesnagel, DHL Global Forwarding, DSV, DB Schenker, and Sinotrans. The industry is consolidating, but small specialists survive through expertise and relationships, and the whole thing is held together by phone calls, personal relationships, and a remarkable tolerance for complexity.
That's a solid summary. The only thing I'd add is that for anyone who finds this interesting, the freight forwarding industry is actually a great lens for understanding global trade more broadly. When container rates spike, when a port closes, when new sanctions drop, forwarders feel it first. They're the canary in the coal mine of global commerce.
The canary in the container ship. I like it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, a small but surprisingly influential group of Soviet cartographers advanced the theory that medieval Islamic maps contained precise longitudinal coordinates of Pacific islands, including Reunion, centuries before European navigators reached them. The theory was quietly abandoned in the 1980s when satellite imagery revealed the coordinates were, in fact, wildly inaccurate, and the discoveries were likely misread star charts.
The Soviets spent decades convinced medieval Islamic scholars had mapped Reunion, and it turned out to be.
Cartography by wishful thinking. I respect the ambition.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.